Blog Talk Radio.
From Carl's Tavern. Today we are at Deviant Legion. We are celebrating Women's History Month. And today we started with the Doctor Who theme, which you may find a little strange, but there's a reason we did that, and I will explain that later. So I want you to imagine that I am in college for my master's and church music in Concordia. And I had a specific, compatriot that also was in school for the same thing at the same time. And it is so nice to reconnect with her. And I'd like to introduce an old friend, compatriot, and boy, did we get into trouble. Henrietta Atkin. Henrietta, it is so wonderful to have you here and to reconnect with you. Seriously, I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah, no, I do too. I remember all the fun we got up to, not too many specific instances, but I know that those of us who took our master's degree, were in some of the undergraduate classes, and I know we stuck out because of our age. And I don't know if it was lack of respect for the teachers, but seeing as we were closer in age, we definitely didn't have an undergraduate attitude towards them.
Hell no. I'm a perfect example of that. Good God.
So we had a good time. It was fun learning. The composition classes were excellent, and we had a number of classes together. We always enjoyed being together and talking together, praying together, and
absolutely.
Yeah, I very specifically remember some of the classes where there were some quite conservative professors there whose theology I didn't necessarily agree with.
You know, one of the ones I remember really strongly, Jonathan Stalky and Jonathan Kors, who was my comp teacher. Do you remember Nathan Jastrom?
No, the class I remember was when one of the professors was telling us like who might go to hell, which I don't know, was or might not be in heaven. And I remember
I remember that. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to be one of them.
No, actually, you gave a real moving tribute to your mom. I remember that. You were just – and I remember the professor saying, well, we commend your mother to God in kind of a posh way. And you kind of stood up and said, hey, I know she's in heaven. She was one of the best people. And, you know, he was just very strict on his particular kind of theology. And I just seem to remember that, you know, you get past the age of 20 or 21 and you're just kind of able to stand up and – sort of say what you really think.
Well, I was in my 40s at the time. And it's like, you're not going to pull this shit on me. Seriously.
Well,
not going to happen.
Yeah, I know. So I think they were somewhat taken aback, but but
I know they were taken aback a little bit. I kind of played that up, to be honest. I'm surprised
Did you ever play the organ at that big church, you know, the church or that we had to play at? You know, they had the big, what do you call
no,
it?
No, no. You know what happened with that? I never did. Okay, so I ended up at Thomas Geeshan's church.
Thomas Geeshan, yeah.
And he was a professor emeritus there, he did all the editing on the parish organist books that were published by Concordia and that, and
yeah,
he hired
books.
Me.
I have a stack of them.
Oh, they're great books.
Yeah, they have a lot of really good volumes.
He hired
in them.
Me, and so when it came down to doing any type of playing or that, it was basically at that church or on one of the practice organs. I never my master's was in composition, so it was I never did the playing at the big organ. I only did it once.
They did it for church services, and it was kind of scary. There were a lot of people there, and they were really far across the room, and I think I did it once. And you know, I switched my major, too. I started out as performance, but then I thought, boy, you know, I really don't like, you know, modern music that much, of the organ literature of modern music that much. I prefer Baroque, or maybe it was more that I preferred to play Baroque. I found playing romantic pieces on the organ difficult because of the need for legato, and the organ is just not really a legato instrument, you know?
No, no, it's not. And I'm much more a pianist.
I am too.
You know, I focus much more on composition, and that's was always my focus, was composition. You know, it just worked out well. You know, I mean, I ended up, you know, before I went to college for my master's, you know, I was running my folk store. I already knew literature, and I was selling print music. And then I ended up afterwards at Music and Arts, which is a large chain, and I was one of their buyers. So. Where I never really did anything with my composition, but I know literature like the back of my hand, and so I've been doing that. And tell me about it. You know, and I would find things. You know, I'd have to find things that were foreign or that were out of print. That was one of the reasons I contacted one of our featured composers today, and I'll get into that later. Now, what we've done...
Yeah, because I hadn't heard of some of them, and I really should know more, you know, women composers.
Well, I've got three of them picked out. Mm-hmm. So what I thought we would do is we would start and play some of the music and the composers that we want to focus on today. And
awesome.
We might as well
great
start
idea.
With you. Because,
oh, no.
Because you gave me
not
three...
me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, are you kidding? Of course we're going to start with you ladies first.
Well, that'd be good. Then I don't have to compare myself to any of the greats, you know.
Okay, so you sent me three untitled pieces. So I just put them as Henrietta 1, 2, and 3. So.
Well, they do have a title. They were originally written.
Well, what we'll do is we'll
I'll
play the first one, and then you can tell us about it, okay?
Okay, that
How
sounds like
that?
A plan. That's probably the best thing. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go with the first of Henrietta's compositions here. Thank you. very nice, sort of a cross between a bit of new age and like I hear a bit of foray in there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good ear catch there. It's meant to be French. Now I do remember the title. I should have told you, but it's called Water Lilies, and it's meant to be impressionistic, but sort of neo-impressionism. And it was in a period, in fact, all the stuff that I've sent you is in a period in my life when I thought I really wanted to pursue my dream that we all have of writing for film and TV. And what I did is I got involved with this organization that's still ongoing and a very helpful organization called TAXI, which is will then take your music, and you can do this by yourself, but it'll take your music and it shops them around to various music libraries in LA, and then it basically the music is used as an underscore. And
right.
So they like this. There was a thing for piano impressionism, so I did it. So, I mean, I can tell you that the end result of all of this work, and it was a tremendous amount of work because I had to learn how to be a music producer, which I know some people are crazy about that kind of thing, but I really didn't enjoy it, you know, learning the skills, and I just found it very tedious and boring, but you have to be your own music producer. And I do have one of my pieces in a LA music library, which is great, you know, but I don't think they've used it for anything. Basically, that whole part of my career I just kind of abandoned just because I found it not very rewarding financially, and it took up a lot of time, and I had other things to do. But so that's what that piece is.
Okay. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, the composition itself in terms of a lot of people don't realize how, you know, putting the notes on the paper. I mean, when did you compose these? What year? Early 2000s?
So long ago. It was right after I left a full-time job in church music, you know, and I have two kids that I adopted. And at this time they were young enough. Ironically, the thing about parenting is the older your children get, the more they kind of need you need your time, you know, just as they're getting ready in high school and college and you want to help them with their career and stuff. But at the time they didn't really need me. And so I think it was 2016, because I think that was when I left the job, or maybe a little earlier. So it was around about that time, not so long ago. And I just set up in my bedroom, and I got my, what do you call it? Not finale.
It's the
Apple computer. No, Sibelius. It's the one you get through Apple computers. They're selling it, you know, but it's not a lot. I mean, anyone can produce music these days. So I just set that up, and I actually hired someone who would work for Apple to help teach me how to be a music producer. He came in every week, and I just got started. And then I would, you know, I got some of my commissions on Upwork, and I would just do anything because I was freelance at that point. I only had one church job. So, and then I kind of worked up and joined TAXI. But yeah, like you said, it's not just putting notes on a page. I mean, like when we got the brief to write for impressionistic underscore, you know, I think I did probably get out my foray, and I did start looking at his, of course I got the famous, Gymnopédie. I got the famous, and I looked to see, you know, to see what kind of bass notes he was using and how he created that, you know, how he created that sort of French impressionistic music. And you know, you have to study that, and then you got to write the composition, and then you got to get it, then you got to record it, and then you have to start, you know, physically moving the notes around in your computer screen so that the recording could sound halfway good. It really took a lot of work. But as I said, at the time, my kids were younger, and I could sort of do that, you know.
When I would, like, compose Death Cancer or something like that for flute or whatever the case would be, I still don't use any computer. I still use manuscript, and I still have my straight edge aluminum ruler and still do it that way and have my mechanical pencil and pencil thing.
Trust me, I do too. I jot my ideas down in manuscript, and in fact, with this particular piece, it turned out to be so complex. I wrote the whole thing out long form, but then I had to record it, you see, and that's why this whole process was so time-consuming for something that maybe a music library is not even going to pick up, because a lot of my pieces were sort of too classical. I know a very good – I know a woman who does get a lot of her – pieces in put in LA music libraries, but she's just much more modern sounding, and she grew up with the computer age, and you know, so she, I know some of her pieces were, I mean, they were all good, but there's a lot of competition out there, so you know.
Absolutely.
As I said, this was just this was on my bucket list, and I did, you know, I did get I think I got one piece. Was like, they don't buy them. They sort of, it's almost like they rent them. And so I,
I know how that all works.
Yeah.
Trust me, I do.
Yeah.
We're going to go on to the second piece here. And you can tell us a little bit about this after we listen to this. And this is a little more lively, just to let everyone know.
Okay.
So the only question I have for you is how much Carlos Antonio Jobim did you listen to before you composed that?
I have been playing Jobim for quite a while, ever since in my 20s, way before my master's in church music. I studied jazz, and I have definitely been studying jazz seriously around about the same time I started taking lessons with Dave Frank. So I've that's something I've been able to really incorporate into my improvisations at church, and not only Jobim, but another one of my favorites, Vince Guaraldi, who I think is a genius. I hope
there's some Guaraldi in there too.
Yes. So I love him. He's amazing. Of course, I love Jobim. You know, I've got my jazz fake book, and I love all of his compositions. So that's
all I have to say is after I listened to that in the first time, I started singing The Girl from Ipanema, so just wanted you to know.
An awesome piece. I never get tired of that piece. But that one, you know, again, was not that popular when I sent it in to Taxi. I didn't even get what they call a forward on that. But I really enjoyed composing it. I love that childlike. I love that Mr. Rogers type of jazz, you know, that they play in the background.
Yeah.
The Mr. Rogers. I love that stuff. And the thing with underscore is it's not meant to be that fancy because it's meant to be underscored. It's meant to be unobtrusive. So, again, a lot of my friends that I chat with on Facebook, they've been very successful in this. They get stuff on soap operas, and some of my friends who just play guitar, they get underscores placed on some of these cable TV swampy shows, like, you know, the like the old Southern, swamp fishing family who lives on the creek, you know. And they're very talented.
Okay, one of those.
So, but, you know, I come from a more classical background, and it would take a real long time for me to kind of change my style. But I did, I'm really glad that I've gotten to study a lot more jazz in the last 5 years, and that's influenced my probably playing at work and improvisation. And I think to be a good composer, you have to be a good improviser. So that I realized after a while that was where my real passion lay, and I've been studying that a lot more, and I've gotten more skilled at it. And so I'm happy to do things. I think, well, I could comment on the next thing you're going to play, but it's fun to take a hymn and play around with it. I wasn't able to do that at the time of my master's degree. I didn't have the musical knowledge, and they weren't teaching that, but I've learned by myself, you know. And that's where my passion lies.
And that's the next thing. With this next piece, of course, both of us are church musicians. And we a lot of what we were taught in Concordia, of course, I always say that I loved going to Concordia because it was not a performance school. It was more about the liturgy and things like that. So a lot of us who play at churches, we all play hymns, and so sometimes we want to do something different with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this next piece is. So we're just going to go right into it, Anna. So here we go.
Okay.
Nice. It's Christmas time already.
Absolutely. Now, that one actually caught the ear of the music library that I have three songs in, and they liked that one. They accepted that one. I don't know if they even know that it's a Christmas hymn, although I told them. But, you know, I just took a simple, it's an African-American spiritual, and which, of course, lends itself very well to a jazz reharmonization, because African-American music is the foundation of all jazz, right? So
Right.
It worked really nicely. Yeah. And so that's pretty much what I do now. That's pretty much where my heart is taking a hymn, reharmonizing it. I even recently started taking a course about Baroque, about the improvisation practices of Baroque music, which I would recommend to anyone. It's only like $5 a month. Professor John Mortensen teaches it on Patreon. He might have moved to another platform, but he basically is saying, look, all the great composers were improvisers. They knew, you know, there were certain formulae that they composed in, so he teaches it to us, and that's also been really fun because, you know, a lot of our hymns are Baroque harmonized.
Absolutely.
Harmonized by Baroque. Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, what that Go Tell on the Mountain, that's right where I'm at right now musically, just really enjoying that, you know, the aspect of being free with the church music that we can play, you know.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to move on here. Oh, finish up. I'm sorry, Mom.
No. I don't have much to say other than, you know, my journey as a composer, you know, I started out thinking, oh, maybe I could produce music for film and TV. But, you know, we have to listen to our muses, right, to our heart, to what really wants to come out. And that's sort of where I'm at, you know, is just really enjoying, you know, performing at church and a lot of freedom with the music. So, yeah.
Well, good. So now we're going to move on to some other composers. And I'm going to start with someone that I am very, very fond of. I've actually had a chance to talk to her a couple times during my career. Now,
wow.
When I was young, I was only allowed, or we as a family were only allowed to listen to classical music and Broadway tunes up until I was like five or six, right?
Well, at least
no,
you got the
seriously,
Broadway
I'm not joking.
But...
So the first thing I learned, if I wanted to annoy my parents, I would play 20th century classical. And
oh, right,
throughout
right,
the years, I that's where my heart is. I mean, I love 20th century. I love experimentation. Now, Emma Lou Deemer is the composer we're talking about. She was born in 1927. She's still alive, and she's still composing, and she's on Facebook. And she actually is still composing so that you can basically just take it and play it. And she is a church.
Wow.
She's basically known for church. I have several of her old collection of hymn preludes published by like Sacred Music Press and Santa Barbara and that. She's published all over the place. She's written several hymns that are in hymn books. But she also does a lot of experimental stuff. She's done symphonies and chamber music, and she's really something. One of the things she does is she sort of compartmentalizes. She does some very, very 20th century things, and then for her church stuff, it's for anyone to play, you know, and so she's very, very
really neat.
Yeah, and trust me, I actually play some of her pieces, but because they're accessible. I don't consider myself a great organist, a great pianist. I'm certainly capable. But, you know, she does things that I can do that have wonderful harmonies and things like that. So what we are going to do now is one of my favorite pieces of hers is Toccata for Piano. I will tell you about this piece. That you must play this on a grand piano because there are certain specific things you do, like hit the strings inside the piano and so on and so forth. So to play this piece, you have to be somewhat dexterous. I will also warn you that there are parts of this where there is silence, okay? So if you think the piece has ended, it's not. And I'm going to warn you that this is probably the most dissonant piece you will hear tonight. But I love this piece. This is Toccata by Emma Lou Deemer. Come on. And that is Toccata by Emma Lou Deemer. If you look at the YouTube of that, Henrietta, it's amazing mm-hmm. what this woman does with it. It was, I don't know her name, but it was a student that was going for her master's in performance doing that piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a beautiful piece. I love it. The first thing that comes to mind in terms of the impression, you know, the pictures it was painting for me, was some of Olivier Messiaen's piece that I know we heard when we were at Concordia. You know, I know he wrote a lot of pieces about, you know, like about birds, right? And it just reminded me of that. It reminded me, it created that kind of feeling, although it was very different, of course. But I love the piece. Very interesting, exciting, listenable. It really a treat. Really enjoyed it, yeah.
Well, one of the things I really like about her is her sense of harmony. She really mm-hmm. reharmonizes something in quite a different way than what you expect. But also, mm-hmm. if you listen to that piece, and most of the pieces that we listen to are that people suppose that women write are you know, nice, listenable pieces and not something mm-hmm. with that type of power. That has a lot of power to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that
20th
really
century,
spoke,
for sure.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. That was mm-hmm. written in 1977, actually.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, and as I said, she's still on Facebook. She's still kicking. Mm-hmm. And she really is something I, over the years, what I did, you know, was I basically knew a lot of literature, and I sold print music for most of my lifetime. And so times, mm-hmm. you know, you're looking for a piece and you can't find it. So you get in touch with the person saying, is there a manuscript?
Oh, right.
Can
yeah.
we,
yeah.
you know, so I've done that twice in my lifetime and actually talked to Emma and we have, we're on Facebook and we chat occasionally, not too often, but occasionally.
Right.
And when I came up with this idea to do women's composers, she was the first person that I thought of. So I contacted her and she said she'd love to listen to the podcast, which she will do, I'm
yeah.
sure, because I'll give it yeah. to her. But she doesn't do podcasts anymore. And I said, well, that's fine. But just wanted you to know that there are those people out there that appreciate her very, very much.
Yeah. Well, that was really wonderful. I mean, like I said, I've never heard anything of hers before. I'm really glad you shared that. And, yeah, it's a very different sounding piece, you know, for sure.
No, and
very,
I would
very
also,
much something
you know,
I think
people,
anyone.
Oh, yeah. The one thing I would
anyone
say
would
is we're both church musicians.
In church.
And check out her church work too. Her church music is just wonderful.
Oh, I will. Well, I actually I just navigated to her Facebook page, and actually, it's interesting. I see you're there. You're a friend, and I see a few other composers there—not women composers, but people that I know. I won't mention their names. They might not be, you know. But I see there's actually a woman organist here in Chicago who I'm familiar with, who I've talked to in the course of, you know, just being an organist in Chicago. And I see some male composer here. I see an organ builder. I see two very well-known organ performers from the U.S. So, she must be someone that I'm very glad I've met now, because it's obvious that all these very talented people know her, you know. I'm looking at some of the music here. This is right.
Absolutely. We're trying to shine a light on these composers because mm-hmm. the music is worthwhile. You know, it's
yeah,
not just
absolutely.
Because they're women composers and it's Women Composers yeah. Month, you know, and Women's History
yeah.
Month. No, these are
yeah.
great composers, period. Doesn't
yeah,
matter
absolutely. Yeah, they are.
What gender.
Yeah, absolutely.
So who do you want to focus on now?
Well, I know that you and me both picked Amy Beach. Everything I've ever heard from Amy Beach, I've really enjoyed. I know I played a couple of simple pieces of hers. You know, you know what the life of a church musician is like. You're so busy getting the next, you know, weeks together that I often do not have time to learn longer pieces. I will learn short pieces of a page or two page, you know, because we're learning them week to week. I'm lucky that I have a wonderful oboist in my congregation. We of course, use IMSLP, that free music treasure trove on the internet.
Which is wonderful.
Yes, and it's nice for the church's budget, too. So we're working a lot on the sonatas of Vivaldi. We've done Frederick II. We've done, of course, Handel and the various Bach sons and even some Bach. And, you know, we just learn something new week to week. But often something not very long, often some Baroque dance suites. So it's just really nice to hear a longer piece by someone, because I often just don't have the time, you know. So tell me, and you said you had some things to say about Amy Beach as well. So
yeah, I did. So
yeah,
back in the days when I was at Carl Fisher, this was before I went to Concordia. I worked under a gentleman by the name of Wesley Bartlett, and we had really, really very fine people who came in or were our customers. People like Skinner Chavez Mello, who has numerous hymns in the Episcopal hymnal and various hymnals in the Methodist hymnal and so on and so forth. But one of the people that we had was a gentleman by the name of Michael May. And Michael May did the Union Chorale out of New Jersey. And he wanted to do a concert of Amy Beach, but this was before any of her stuff was republished, okay? So it had all gone into, it was all basically out of print. Now, Carl Fisher had treasure trove of old octavos that we never cleared out. And so it was up to Wesley and I to do all this work for Michael to find some of the old octavos of, at that point, it was Mrs. H.H.A. Beach. She wasn't even known as Amy at that point. And we found a lot of this stuff, and he prepared a concert, and he premiered it at Carnegie Hall. And both Wesley and I went to it. We actually, you know, were invited. We didn't have to pay for our seats. And we were actually thanked by Michael May from the stage and had to stand up for all the work we did for this concert. So
this, Carl? What year?
This had to be, I would think it was about 83. 82 or 83.
And her work was still not all that known at that point.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Wow.
In fact,
I'm kind of
Michael
shocked.
Was one of the re-
now,
Michael
really
was one of the reasons that there was this reinterest in Amy Beach. I'm sure Michael needs to be really thanked for that, because there's no question that as soon as he did this concert, it wasn't a year later that her stuff was being reprinted and reintroduced. So,
well, that's really, that's
so, yeah,
really great.
So I actually have had a slight hand in that one. I'm always proud of that.
That's true.
I miss Michael very.
Yeah, I would be too.
You know, Michael, unfortunately, a lot of our customers at Carl Fisher, that was during the AIDS crisis, and Michael was gay, and Michael passed away from AIDS.
Oh, yeah.
And I was actually
one of
the
lost a lot of great artists then.
Absolutely.
That was a very tragic time. I remember that time. I remember living in Newtime at that time and seeing a lot of the afflicted, you know, because it was just very much, you know, a devastating, just devastated the artistic community in the U.S. We'll never really know what the loss is. Yeah.
So what we're going to do is, you picked Romance by Amy Beach. So we're going to listen to that now, and we'll have your comments afterwards.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you. lovely.
Mm.
That is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very nice.
So give us your thoughts on why you picked that piece from Amy Beach.
Well, I'll be honest, it's not actually a piece I'm all that familiar with. So picked it because what famous I had listened to a famous violin sonata. I think it was the Mendelssohn E minor. And I guess I wanted to pick this one to see if it would compare. And I think it does. I think it sounds really lovely. And I'm impressed by the way that she, you know, expanded her ideas very smoothly. Because it's challenging writing a longer piece, you know.
I mean, oh, absolutely.
It's just to keep it interesting. And I think that the way that she transitioned from one idea to another was very interesting and very smooth and very lovely, obviously in the romantic idiom. But, you know, sort of not late romanticism, just sort of the normal sort of harmonies you would expect in maybe early romantic style. I just really enjoyed it. How about you? What did you think about it?
It's a lovely piece. I do know the piece. Mm.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, the wonderful thing about a piece like that is it just takes you away.
Mm-hmm.
You're
absolutely
no longer in your room and looking at the computer. You're somewhere else. So just closing your eyes and listening to that just transports you. And that's what music does, right? I mean, that's what it's supposed to do anyway.
Well,
that kind of
music, yeah. I mean, that, you know, the piece that she wrote, it does take you away. In terms of the use of the violin and how high it goes, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of Ray Vaughan Williams' Lark Ascending. That is another piece that take you away, you know. And I think the violin has that quality too, the solo violin with either a piano or orchestra, just to kind of take you away the higher the notes go. Which, of course, is the beauty of the instrument, yeah. And I like what you said about that, you know, the ability to take you away and, you know, calm you down and calm your breathing down. The power of music is amazing. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we're going to move on to a composer that I love for what she did in experimentation. Now, we started the show with the Doctor Who scene. And
that
so there's a reason.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I'll talk afterwards.
Okay. But the reason is because we're focusing on a composer by the name of Delia Derbyshire. And I'll explain that to you. You're about to say something, Henrietta, so go right ahead while I get to the Wikipedia page.
Well, you know, because you know I was born in the U.K., which is where the Doctor Who series originated. And I've been through a number of doctors. And of course, my older daughter, my older adopted daughter, I have two adopted children, is crazy about Doctor Who. And so she, of course, likes the Doctor Who, David Tennant, you know. But, you know, I'm immediately brought back to the mid-70s with trays of baked beans on toast in Britain and watching Doctor Who and hearing that theme, you know. And seeing the Daleks and all the other.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's a classic theme. So.
Absolutely. So the story about that is she was working as a trainee assistant studio manager in 1960, and 62 she assisted composer Luciano Berio in a 2-week summer school in Darlington Hall, which she borrowed several dozen items of BBC equipment. And then in 1963, she was asked to do an electronic realization of a score by Ron Grenier for the theme of Doctor Who. Okay, so Ron Grenier composed the theme, but it's her work on all this electronic equipment and that. And if you see pictures of her, these are like, this is 1962. So it would take this whole room I'm in. Okay? And it's all these tapes that she has to work with and that sort of thing. So she did this, and she recreated and produced this theme entirely with electronics. When Grenier heard
wow.
it, he was so amazed by the arrangement. He asked, "Did I really write this?" To which Derbyshire replied, "Most of it," which I love.
I pulled up a picture now on Wikipedia, and I see what you mean by those giant tape machines.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. So she did a lot of work for the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And just to say, she was never credited on screen for her work on mm-hmm. the Doctor Who theme until mm-hmm. the day of the Doctor's 50th anniversary. Series, and now on each of the new Doctor Who's since then, the theme is by Ron Grenier and Derbyshire. She also did the score to one of my favorite horror movies of the 70s, which is The Legend of Hell House, and you should listen to that because it's electronics and some instruments, particularly bass clarinet and bassoon, that she uses to really give some very eerie soundscapes. And she worked with many composers over the years and influenced a lot of people like Aphex.
I'm reading
Twins.
That. I've pulled up her website, and it says the sights and the sounds of the Blitz would help her shape her unique sonic palette. Isn't that strange?
Yes. Well, if you live through the Blitz, you know, it's you hear those sounds of the rockets and that, and she was able to use that, for her compositions, and she had the ability to reproduce that because of the early computer systems. She was really something. Now, one of the thing that I have here, what we're going to listen to here is there was a special in BBC, I think it's 1967. Where Anthony Newley had a special on BBC, and one of the pieces that he sang was written by Delia Derbyshire, all mm-hmm. with electronic, and they did it with animation. And this is called Bloogies Bloogies, and this is Delia Derbyshire with Anthony Newley, and this is a fun
mm-hmm.
little piece. You'll enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
doesn't know me. I'm watching certain vines, and I'm really scared of little pink leaves moving away. Wild air galloping about the wind. Mad ears, the clowns, but you see, like gear. The hip hops are plastic wrapped, their gold and helmeted, booted and spurred. Thank God I can control myself. A little dream in my high place, face. A little scene tucked away in my memory. A little girl and me went case, face. Rain kept falling, she stopped calling. She thinks she's lonely and thinks about me. I got the moochies, the tricky brooches. A little girl just walked by me. See, a little smile in her eyes, here we go again. A little rise in my blood rate. It's stop raining, who's complaining? Goodbye, Bluejuice, bye-bye, Bluejuice. Oh, excuse me, sweetheart. My friend and I are having an argument. He says you're a fashion model. I say you're a film star. And I said a few quid, and I wondered if... Oh, by the way,
so that's a little interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved it, especially the beginning part, the kind of raindrop sound.
Right.
You know, I'm probably going to show my complete ignorance about electronic music, but of course I think the introduction that the ordinary schoolgirl of my age got to it was, of course, in 1972 with Tubular Bells. Now, is that even electronic music? But I just remembered that that is being completely different sound than anything I had ever heard of. And I'm sure she sounds like she was a forerunner to... Go ahead.
Well, she was. She was one of the first. Mm-hmm. And she's actually married to Milton Subotnick, too, who is one of the major people in electronic music. I was introduced to it... I can't think of the composer's name right now, but I knew people like Harry Partch and things like that, the real experimental composers. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories is my composition teacher at Concordia was Jonathan Kors, and he was the adjunct.
Right.
Jonathan Stalky was the main person. There's a reason I went with Jonathan Kors, but we won't go into that.
Mm-hmm.
But Jonathan, he gave me, we had this first talk, you know, they always talk to you first before they really start working with you as, with mm-hmm. your composition. And, you know, I told him the story about how much I love 20th Century. So he gave me two CDs to listen to and one to sort of judge where I was. One was an opera mm-hmm. by Todd Machover, which was all electronic. Which was Valis, which is based on the Philip K. Dick novel. And the other one was Music for Blooms, okay, which was, you know, mm-hmm. scratching blooms, right? Basically threw that out of the eye. I'm not there. This one I like. Okay.
Well,
now we know where you are.
That's not the most terrible sound you could get, but there's only so much of it you can tolerate, you know.
Absolutely. So in this case, you know, he got an idea, but I loved electronic music. And you talked about Tubular Bells. Some of that was computer generated, but particularly by the Moog, you know.
Right, the famous Moog, yeah.
Right, you know, Bob Moog, he died for your sins. Anyway, mm-hmm. bad joke.
Most
of that,
I've got to admit.
Well, synthesizers. Never mind. I'm trying to explain
right.
the joke.
Okay, now I got it. Okay.
but anyway, Tubular Bells was one musician. That was Mike Oldfield. He played every instrument.
Wow.
And then it was re-recorded on a four track like four times, so that
right.
they would have 16
okay.
tracks.
Right.
And it really is something. I mean, there were a lot
beautiful.
Of things.
It's beautiful. It really is nice.
You know, one of my favorite musicians also is Frank Zappa, and he did a lot of that, and he did a lot of electronic work, too.
He did a lot of
experimental
stuff.
In fact, he basically developed the synclavier, and he did that because there was a composer by the name of Conlon Mancaro, who back in the day, you had player pianos, and he would poke his old holes and player piano rolls to play something that humans couldn't. And so, you know, that was the idea with synclavier, too, that you could program it to play things that humans couldn't possibly play. And
right,
so it's,
yeah, of
it's
course,
this,
yeah.
It's this expansion of sound and expansion of what we can do, which is all what technology is, you know?
Yeah.
And look what you do now with computers and everything and phones, and you can shoot a movie on your phone now. And I know people that do that.
I know.
I
know. And then, of course, perversely, people are wanting to, or at least a lot of the briefs that I used to get through taxi were, well, we want this to sound as authentic as possible. So you often could not use, like, a synthesized or a sample of, say, a French horn. You had to, like, get a French horn player into your home because we can tell, you know, when it's from one of these beautiful sample houses. And you know, look at the trend towards long playing records now that people are saying, oh, well, it sounds better. And I don't know. It's like the more we move forward, then people want to move backward as well. So that's human nature, of course, I suppose.
Absolutely. So we're going to move on to your last pick here. And who? I guess it's Fanny Mendelssohn. So tell us a little bit about this piece.
Again, it's a piece I'm not super familiar with, but I have heard a lot about Fanny Mendelssohn. You know, when I pick my composers, I just tend to pick the people who fascinate me or who are going to, like, help me where I'm at musically. I personally have always loved the sound of Chick Corea and his music and the way he improvises. So, you know, I just tend to pick my composers, not necessarily if they're male or female. So having said that, you know, when you asked me to pick women's composers, I did think of Fanny Mendelssohn because, you know, I had heard that she is quite a composer and could have developed further were it not for the very conventional way that she was brought up. So, for example, Clara Schumann, you know, was given the freedom to compose, but from what I understand, she was more the brilliant performer. You know, that's where her genius lay. But I heard that Fanny Mendelssohn, you know, was quite a good composer. And some people are saying, oh, well, are these pieces that, you know, we thought were written by him, were they written by her? So that's why I picked her as my second composer. I don't really know that much about the piece.
Okay, so we're going to listen to the Notturno in G minor by Fanny Mendelssohn, and here we go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Lovely piece.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
That's a lovely piece.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely say she could have been a composer of, you know, some merit there. She definitely had the talent. And so, yeah, I'm glad I got to hear that piece. It was beautiful. It's really lovely.
You know, one of the things, too, that I want to bring out with the two of us is that there are women composers of every stripe, you know, and
right.
you deal more with the romantic and that, and I'm more 20th century, but there's
mm-hmm.
so many, you know, there's Hildegard Bingen, who was, you know, in the medieval times, and there's so
right.
many great women composers, and there are several publishers out there that
mm-hmm.
focus specifically on women publishers. So please, on women composers. So please, you know,
yeah.
to everyone listening today, you know, make a point. You know, Rachel was supposed to be here with us, and we were going to talk about Florence Price, African American
right.
Composer from Little Rock.
I have heard of some of her music, and actually, this is just coming up in me right now because I'm just finally remembering. We took some of the songs she had written, and me and this oboist at church, we did play some of her songs at church. So thank you for reminding me of Florence Price. She is an African-American
mm-hmm.
composer. And she wrote some beautiful pieces that my oboist had heard on WBEZ in Chicago. He's like, this woman is great. And so, yeah, we have played her at my church. And she
mm-hmm.
Writes some wonderful stuff.
You know, and one of the things that with my background, I worked at Carl Fisher, a publisher, in the 80s, and then I worked at my own store, you know, in print music, and then, of course, worked for Music and Arts. And you get
mm-hmm.
all these people asking for things you've never heard of, or you get to see them
yeah.
in new issues, and you know, you get inundated with this stuff. And I've always found women composers that I just think are wonderful composers that people don't know. And we're going to end up with one of my favorites, and that's Thea Musgrave. Thea Musgrave is an English composer. She, again, is still living, and she's in her 90s now. But she was born in Banton, Edinburgh. And she started composing in the 60s. She studied
mm-hmm.
with Aaron Copland. She was also a student of Nadia Boulanger. I almost did Nadia and Lily, who are two great French composers. Nadia
mm-hmm.
is more known for her teaching ability, and
yeah.
she taught
she's
so taught many,
many
great
greats. Yeah.
Classical composers of the 20th century. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, these women are very, very vital to the growth of music in the
mm-hmm.
20th century. But we're talking about Thea Musgrave, and she has written over 12 operas. She's done several other musical theater works. Some of her operas are Mary, Queen of Scots, Harriet Tubman, Simon Bolivar, Pontalba, and she was interviewed by somebody at the BBC and about Musgrave's view of being a woman composer. She replied, "Yes, I'm a woman and I am a composer, but rarely at the same time."
Mm-hmm.
Which I love that quote.
Mm-hmm.
And she also admitted that pursuing music can be a very difficult career. When asked by the BBC to offer advice to young composers, she replied, "Don't do it unless you have
mm-hmm.
to. And if you do, enjoy every damn minute of it." I love that quote.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're going to listen to is part of her Orfeo trilogy, which is in three parts. And this is the second part. And this is a lovely piece, and I think you'll really enjoy
mm-hmm.
it. And
okay,
this
yeah,
is
I'm looking forward to it.
Orfeo Part 2 by Thea Musgrave.
Okay.
Thea Musgrave, correct.
That is Orgio, part two.
Oh, that was beautiful. Beautiful. So very light, yeah, very compelling. And when I say light, I don't mean it doesn't lack gravitas. I mean, it's just pleasantly like a pleasant breeze to listen to. It doesn't overburden you.
Well, I find it very ethereal, that it floats.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
That there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And there are those birds. The flute.
Go ahead.
Bird sounds are very nice, you know, the flute. And really sets the mood, you know.
Absolutely. And we were talking about Now I forget his name. The French organ composer who does bird sounds.
Olivier Messiaen. Yeah.
Messiaen. Yeah. And she knew Messiaen, so I'm sure there was some sort of influence. You know, no question about that. She's really something. I really like that piece a lot, and I do.
Yeah,
I've heard a couple of her operas, and I really like her work. I always have.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that I know about her, I will listen more to her. So that's great. And the whole point of why we have Women's History Month and women composers to, you know, let the world know about these women who, you know, sometimes through no fault of their own. I was just reading a little bit about forgotten her first name, Ms. Darby. And she was not allowed, they did not hire women back in the 50s when she applied to the BBC. And so she found another way to get
Derbyshire.
Derbyshire, yeah. And she found another way to get her music in by just, you know, some kind of back channel. But, you know, it was so often that women helped out and, you know, didn't get credited for their work. And it's wonderful that we're now able to appreciate the work that women, you know, have done in the field of music. So that was a beautiful piece. And I'm very glad to hear, to learn about the name of Thea Musgrave. Very United Kingdom type of name.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one of the things that over the years that I've always championed the lesser known composers and you know, whether they be women or men, it didn't matter to me. And the beauty of what I did over the years in working in print music was you get all this information and suddenly there are new names and choral people that no one else knows that you push. And I've tried to do that all my life, not only with music, but our main focus here at Deviant Legion, our podcast group, is film and pop culture. So I work with first-time film directors and people that aren't well-known that do micro-budget work and so on and so forth. And we try to really promote, you know, this underclass to really let people know that there's some amazing work out there by people you've never heard of. And
sure.
You should hear
them. And it's very important because, you know, let's face it, sometimes our mainstream stuff can be really kind of boring. And it's great now that we have that so much, for example, I'm sure Amazon and Netflix are now considered mainstream, but it's still another opening for people to get known. I'm thinking of that young black woman, I've forgotten her name, but she started out on YouTube with just filming herself as the awkward, she's like, I'm the awkward young black woman and I never see a character like me on mainstream TV. And she got a lot of hits on her YouTube channel and now she's a major producer, you know, producing her own show. I've forgotten what the show is called, but I did
watch
some
of her. I can't think of your name either, but I do know who you mean.
Yeah. And so it's wonderful that we now have these ways of these outlets for people, for everyone to get a chance to be seen and not the same old, you know, boring, you know, I don't know. Who was it that, I forgot, someone said that there's, you know, we all have one story in us at least. And like Charles Dickens apparently was the father-son relationship. And although, of course, he wrote more than one good novel, but you know what I'm saying? It's like we don't always want to hear from the same people. We want to see the foreign film, something different. And I think it's great that you're promoting that because otherwise people are not going to hear about it, you know?
Exactly. And that's the way it was with me in music. When I used to do a choral reading session, I would go through easily 1,000 octavos before I'd pick it down to about 50 or 60 and then give it to the clinician and say, you know, add five of yours and then pick 30 of these. No.
What did your choir think of that, going through 1,000 octavos?
No. This wasn't a choir. This was choral reading sessions. Where what
so you
would
do, like go through it by yourself.
As a store, you would back this, and then you'd invite all the churches around, and the choir directors would come, and go through the music, and then you'd sell the stuff, hopefully, to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a sales stuff. And I that's what I started to do when I was working at Carl Fisher. And mm-hmm. we used to, you know, over the years, I've worked with people like Alec White and Paul Liljestrand, Mark Miller, and various people over the years, and just wonderful, wonderful opportunities to
I wish we still had Carl Fisher around to give those kind of choral readings. I mean, now what happens is the publishers, as I'm sure you know, as a church musician, you know, they will send you out a quarterly package for a fee, and you yourself can read through the octavos. But I don't think they get as much a chance to pick as, say, if we went to a big session at Carl Fisher where you had gone through 1,000 octavos.
Right, and it wasn't just one publisher, because each publisher has its own style. So suddenly you get 20 octavos by Lorenz, and they're the same damn thing, all of them. Right,
exactly.
or nearly all of them. And so what we would do is we would do many publishers. And one of the things that both Wesley taught me and I did particularly was go with the small publishers, the ones nobody knows.
Yes, yes, yes.
And find things that are worthwhile there that separate you from, you know, a J.W. Pepper doing this who does like three publishers and that's all they do.
Exactly, exactly. And so, as I said, I miss, and I remember going down in the 70s and 80s, probably not the 70s, the 80s, down to Carl Fisher and getting the music there. And it was such a selection. And it was rather nice to have it all laid out, as opposed to now, I mean, you go online and
you
can
were there
hear the music.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, you know, you can hear the music online now. But, you know, picking it from, you know, from your study and you hear about 30 seconds of the song and you choose it, it's not quite the same. I miss those giant sort of festivals of music where you could hear a lot of music, you know, from a lot of different publishers. I think it's more valuable to choir directors picking stuff.
Now, when you went down to Carl Fisher, that was the one in Chicago, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or did you go?
Yeah.
I you said in the 80s. In the 80s, I worked at Carl Fisher in New York, so I don't know if you were ever there.
Right. Well, that would have been even bigger than the one in Chicago. But the one in Chicago was huge, and every musician went there.
Huge. I know.
It had two floors,
there too.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it had two floors. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Those days are gone. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, it's a shame. Anyway, Henrietta, it is such a wonderful thing to reconnect. And listen, we got to do this again. You know, maybe not women composers, but composers we love that nobody else knows or something like that. So you know,
that
think
would
about
be a good
that.
Thing
we
for
could do that.
And maybe we could get your friend Rachel on when her child is not too ill. You know.
Absolutely.
Get her on, and you know, when she doesn't have her mom duties. My kids are much
Absolutely.
Older now, and so I don't have to rush them to the emergency room. They can drive themselves. I hope that her little girl is well and doesn't have COVID, and that I get to meet her at some point, because that would be really nice.
Absolutely. All we've got to do now is a very quick what I like to call housekeeping. And what we're going to do is very quickly tomorrow, we have, Adam, Ferenc is doing cathode ray emission, and we're doing a show on the television show Person of Interest. Then on Sunday, TC is going to be with us with Rock This Town Radio. He's going to be working with 90s and newer female artists. Rock and roll. And upcoming this month on the 17th, Patrick Crane, author out of Oklahoma City, and I will be doing a ISF and FNS podcast on a retrospective of the filmmaker Larry Cohen. And then on the 23rd, we welcome author Danny Perry the cult movies 1 and 3 books is coming back, and we're going to be doing a retrospective of the 1942 film 80th anniversary of Jacques Tourneur's and Val Lewton's Cat People, and we'll be talking basically about Val Lewton's filmography. So, and we've got other things coming up. Vicki and I are going to be doing another show on intent this coming week on Wednesday. We'll be talking about Shel Silverstein and The Giving Tree on that.
Right, right.
And so we've got lots going on, and we're going to keep celebrating Women's Month. Again, Henrietta, I want to thank you so much. And it's wonderful to just talk to you again. And, you know,
Carl. I've got happy memories of our time at Concordia together. I always loved your music. I remember listening to a pre-master's recital and really enjoying your master's thesis. And I'm glad that you're doing so well up there in New York, and with your this podcast, I think, is great, promoting art and lesser known but good art, you know. And I was delighted to be a guest on your show today.
Well, we got to do it again, Miss Henrietta. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Absolutely.
Thank you, Charles.
Oh, you're welcome, Henrietta. And thank you, listeners. And at this point, we're all going to say good night. Say good night, Henrietta.
Good night.
Okay,
good night,
bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.